As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
What a week ahead then. A Federal Reserve decision and the payrolls report. They will come to you Wednesday, Friday, respectively. And Secretary Mnuchin heading to China with a big delegation to talk trade at a time when the Commerce Department is wrestling with requests with allies for tariff exemptions. I'm really pleased to say that this morning, this Monday, we're joined by Peter Henry. He is NYU's Stern School of Business Dean Emeritus and economist as well. Peter, fantastic to have you with us on the program to kick off things this week. Good morning.
Good morning. Delighted to be with you.
Let's begin with Secretary Mnuchin going to China, shall we? Heading to Beijing with a big trade delegation. Allies trying to work out whether the tariffs on aluminum and steel apply to them and whether they'll get tariff exemptions extended. Do you have any clarity on the direction of travel of this specific issue, Peter?
Well, I'm not going to be able to forecast how this negotiation is going to turn out. I think that's probably a fool's errand. But I think the big picture to remember here is that the global economy is deeply dependent on the United States and China having good relations. And that's got to be the center sort of negotiating stance of both parties, because forgetting that, we lose sight of the fact that the United States has been benefiting enormously from lower consumer goods prices from trade with China for years. And so in trying to get a better deal in some sense for U.S. corporations, it's imperative to remember that the U.S. economy, the world economy, is a lot better off as a result of having more, not less, trade.
We're sort of losing sight of the fact as well that much of what is on the table is just a proposal on the table and not a real change in policy. Are you surprised that we're a year and change into this administration and actually haven't seen a substantial change in policy? Had a lot of proposals, a lot of rhetoric, but no real change in policy as far as I can see.
Yeah, I think, you've seen a lot of volatility in terms of what's sort of come out of, in terms of proposals from this administration. I mean, you saw it about a week ago now when President Trump indicated he wanted to be back as part of TPP and then not part of TPP. I mean, I think that's the sort of thing you're alluding to, a bigger vision around trade, which says, look, the United States is only 5% of the world's population, but we're 25% of global GDP, and that would never happen without a world of free trade. And in fact, we should be pushing for more of that and creating more of a positive sum outcome, which will be good not only for the United States, but be good for the world. But in particular, would be good for the U.S. consumers and U.S. workers. And no, we haven't seen that.
We had a day of hope on Friday between North and South Korea, and the president actually congratulating President Xi. Some warm words for President Xi for the amount of pressure that he's put on North Korea. I guess a big question mark at this point is whether we can continue to blend the foreign policy effort of this administration with the international trade story as well, because the president himself has done that. And you just wonder whether there's an open door to walk back some of this rhetoric on trade now that some improvement has been made on the North Korea side of things.
Well, I think it's an important point. I think that anything which, if you will, sort of de-escalates the rhetoric around trade wars and retaliation and recognizes the positive sum nature of global trade, I think would be useful. It would be useful from the point of view of not backing people into corners, but also I think markets would welcome that as well. And I think that would reduce some of the volatility we've seen recently.
Just in terms of what markets are looking at this morning, deal flow really picking up. Another one crossing the Bloomberg Marriott Vacations to acquire ILG in a cash and stock deal. And Tom Keene, you add that onto Sprint T-Mobile this morning, a deal with Marathon in the oil space, the energy space. And over in the UK, of course, Walmart selling that stake in Asda to Sainsbury's too. So a lot of deal flow this Monday morning.
I wonder, higher rates, like money was cheap, let's get it done now.
Maybe.
I really wonder about that.
A lot of stock deal in this, and you just look at the equity as a currency, and I think some companies are trying to spend it while they can.
Yeah, well, let's go with that. We got Dean Henry with us, which is a good reason to, I should say, excuse me, John, Dean Emeritus Henry with us as well.
I just called him Peter.
I should point out, can we call you Peter?
Absolutely.
long before you darkened the door at NYU, it was one of my original sponsors. And we always thank Stern School of Business for their support of Bloomberg on the Economy and Bloomberg Surveillance.
Well, thank you. We've had a lot of your students over the years, and they've done very well.
Really?
Yes, they have.
Yeah. I mean, Tania, I think, pulled a quality C, you know.
Can we just think of Tania for a little while, that she's been called Tania? No, on I think, Bloomberg, you know, Surveillance.
It was
forever.
A miracle she got through Stern.
Did you force students to listen to this?
Yeah, they do. It's a forced podcast. For the first time, I will have two books of the summer. That's how good the book flow has been. Garrett Graff's The Threat Matrix is on the Federal Bureau of Investigation and on the Robert Mueller that we don't know. And the other book took at least 3 seconds to decide to feature is a book of the summer. Robert Kaplan, Agree or Disagree, has driven the debate on realist foreign policy in America for decades. His new book, The Return of Marco Polo's World, is a set of articles and new observations, which is definitive. Robert Kaplan joins us in Washington in our 99.1 FM studios. He is with Eurasia Group, Ian Bremershop, among other abilities. What's your number one message to Mr. Mnuchin going to China, Robert Kaplan?
I think the number one message, Tom, is to preserve the relationship that that trade has the ability, if you have a really, tumultuous trading relationship that's not well-defined, that's not on board, this affects the military situation in the South and East China Sea. It affects politics throughout the Indo-Pacific and Central Asia. In other words, trade is not isolated. It's all part of a geopolitical mix.
Within the synthesis, and this is the heart of your book, is the complexities that need to be thought through. The reality is we have a president who is bilateral, he says, and many would say my deal or the highway is the theory. How do you drag this president into a more complex discussion?
I think what you do is first of all, you have advisors. And the advisors, as extreme as some of them may be, are still far more nuanced than the president is. And you just tell him that, if you do this, here are all the consequences. Here are all the second and third and fourth order effects. And China is developing a society and a system that is going to be, that is going to be not only a great competitor of the United States, it already is, but is on track to overtake the United States in the decades to come unless we're very careful and can compete with them throughout Eurasia and the rest of the world in a very sly fashion.
So, Robert, at the moment, and Jonathan, by the way, speaking, and great to have you with us on the program. Thank you for joining us, Robert. The question for me is, China sort of establishes this Silk Road strategy for the whole region. What is the geostrategic sort of aim of the United States and this administration for Asia right now?
Well, I think we've had 75 years of liberal world order building, and the mistake that many of us have made is to think that that's normal. But in the long span of history, the period between 1945 and the coming to power of Donald Trump has been an historical aberration. Most of history is geopolitical jockeying, positioning, wars, competition, rivalry. And trade can be just an adjunct to geopolitical rivalry, whereas free trade is an adjunct to liberal world order building. So what Trump really signifies is a return in, is counterintuitive as this sounds. Trump actually signifies a return to a more traditional form of world history.
Expand on that a little bit. What will the implications, the consequences of that approach be, Robert?
Well, the consequences are this. The 20th century was about ideological warfare, and that led to the deaths of tens of millions, 150 million people in two world wars, etc. Geopolitical conflict is less bloody. But it's equally tumultuous. If you look at the 18th century, the 19th century, the problems, of British Foreign Minister Castlereagh during the Napoleonic Wars, this is the period we're back to, where you have the United States, China, and Russia competing with each other, with lesser powers like Iran, India, etc., where a bipolar world during the Cold War was very stable. But we're entering a world where it's not even multipolarity. It's more fractured than that.
Robert Kaplan, one final question, and these are people that have actually read your books and I'm no doubt will give a serious skim and full read of The Return of Marco Polo's World. How should Republican State Department types respond to this president? Many are saying they won't serve this president. I think of Nick Burns with his public service, Richard Haass with his public service, and others. Should they stay away from this president, or with a new Secretary of State, should they choose to serve as a public duty?
Tom, the way it works in Washington is we have such a vast imperial system of undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, deputy undersecretaries, and on, that you decide to serve based on whether you trust the person who's hired you. So if they trust Mike Pompeo at State, they should go to work for him. If they trust Jim Mattis at the Defense Department, they should go to work for him. If they do not trust John Bolton at National Security, they should not go to work for him. It's a very diversified system, so that it, you know, of course it matters who's the president, but what matters particularly is who their boss is and if they can trust their boss both morally and philosophically. Yeah.
Robert Kaplan, thank you so much for visiting us today. His book, my book of the summer, The Return of Marco Polo's World. I'll feature that out on social.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
We like to do interviews after interview where there is a theme and there is good conversation. We did that with Ian Bremmer Thursday, Friday last week. Robert Kaplan joining us with his wonderful The Return of Marco Polo's World, one of my books of the summer. And now joining us, James Trevidas, who had my book of the summer a year or two ago, his Leaders Bookshelf, just absolutely superb. He is, of course, at Fletcher School. Admiral Stavridis, good morning. In Robert Kaplan's book, chapter after chapter, he circles back to where he was with the Asia Cauldron of 5 years ago, which is the South China Sea and submarines. Does your U.S. Navy need a new Hyman Rickover to drive forward submarine development?
We've actually got a terrific chief of naval operations who is a submariner, Tom, Admiral John Richardson, and he's just superb. He focuses on the connections between our submarine force, cyber technology, unmanned vehicles, and our ability to use our strategic deterrence at sea. So that Rickover is walking the streets today, and we're lucky to have him.
Do we need a larger Navy? Robert Kaplan says, no, we need a more intelligently deployed Navy. But if we're going to have a return of Marco Polo, the span from at least the Persian Gulf across the Indian Ocean, through the Straits of Malacca, up through South China Sea, up to Korea with all the news last week, that screams to be Navy, Navy, Navy.
It does indeed. And my latest book, Tom, is Sea Power, the History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. And it talks about this. What we have to recognize is that Marco Polo went from east to west. What's happening now from west to east? One belt, one road. China is reversing the voyages of Marco Polo and moving across that area. And so we need a bigger Navy. I don't think it has to be thousands of ships, but we're only at about 270. We need to be up around 320, 330 ships. We'll get there, but we also need to deploy it more intelligently and focus, as you said, and as Robert Kaplan would agree, on the South China Sea.
Admiral Stavridis, has China ever initiated a conflict with a Western power?
No, they have never done so. And they have always held themselves, and here's really the point, held themselves above the rest of the world. They think of themselves as that middle kingdom between heaven and earth. And they've always felt we don't need to do that. That resulted, of course, in invasions of China from Western powers. Now, what we should remember is that China has attacked other Asian nations in the past and will continue to do that as they consolidate power in the region. And if we don't want the South China Sea and the Western Pacific to turn into a Chinese lake, we're going to have to remain engaged.
Having said that, would we want the Gulf of Mexico to turn into a non-U.S. lake?
You know, in the 19th century, of course, we had the Monroe Doctrine, which was designed for that not to happen. But I think we've matured in our geopolitics, and the idea that the United States has a desire or a need to simply declare the Gulf of Mexico territorial sea and build a nine-dash line around it is preposterous. And I don't think that we should allow China to do the equivalent around the South China Sea.
Having said that, are we misinformed in terms of what we believe to be the threat from China?
I think that there is a little bit of China hysteria out there to the degree that we believe China wants to dominate the world. I don't think they do, but here's what they want. They want control of the South China Sea because it represents hydrocarbons, which is the missing card in their strategic suite. They want the ability to dominate East Asia and move their goods in the way they want to, and they want to get into the Indian Ocean. So they're not reaching for global hegemony, but really regional control. It would not be a good thing for the United States to cede that to China at this point.
Does the president understand that dialogue? I haven't seen, and I'm talking more from a military standpoint, Admiral, I mean, we've got the trade discussion and a bilateral slash my way or the highway dialogue. But does the president understand a Stavridis Kaplan world?
I don't think he does. And, of course, he famously is not a great reader of books, but a lot of your listeners are, Tom. And on this one, I'd recommend Graham Allison. He's a brilliant professor
yep,
over
on.
At Harvard.
Yes.
His new book, Destined for War, China and the U.S. in the 21st Century. And as you know, Tom, there's no question mark at the end of that title. So Graham takes a pretty aggressive view toward China. I think if you read that book, you get a pretty good understanding. Perhaps someone should summarize it for the president.
Do you believe that there will be a war between the United States and China?
I do not. I believe over the long term, throughout this century, our interests converge more than they diverge. But if we are foolish about it and are either too aggressive, that would lead to war. Or if we're too passive, that would lead to war. We have to kind of dial this one in.
I'm going to put out on Twitter, folks, Bloomberg Radio will see it first. Sea Power, by James Trevidas. It is just read it for the first time the Admiral went to sea. You don't have to read it for anything else. He's like in the smallest boat in the Navy. He's got his floaties on his arms. He's like 18 or 19 years old. And he's going out of San Diego Harbor. And, you know, it's just that alone is worth reading. Right now, Sarah Senator joins us with Bernstein. We love having her on to talk about, I guess, our national diet and our national food. And Sarah, I want to ask a basic McDonald's 101 question, which is from Butch Cassidy. Who are these guys? And I do that looking at the 2017 annual report, quote, "We have committed to getting more of our restaurants in the hands of our franchisees and developmental licensee strategic partners." There's enough ease in there for me to know that's a bunch of hot air. Who is McDonald's? Do they really own the restaurants that we're eating out of?
I don't know if I would characterize that as hot air, because to answer your question, McDonald's is a brand owner. So their job, frankly, is to do things that for the brand. So think about marketing and menu innovation and essentially how they want their global footprint to look. And then they leave it in the hands of their partners, the franchisees, the licensees, to execute against that plan. So, yes, there are a lot of E's in there, but I don't think that diminishes the fact that this strategy is working for them.
The strategy has been brilliant with lower revenue growth. Explain how you go from $27 billion of revenue down to 21-ish, 22-ish billion, and that's a good thing. What does it mean that they're $5 billion short on revenue from where they were a couple of years ago?
In this case, one of the rare cases where shrinking the top line is a good thing, because it reflects the fact that instead of running restaurants, they're just collecting the royalty from them. So instead of reporting 100% of sales for a restaurant, they're only reporting, call it 15% of sales. But those 15% are very high margin. They basically have minimal costs associated with them, just the cost of owning the real estate, as McDonald's tends to do, and not much else.
Beautifully explained, Pim. They take 45 cents or so down to EBITDA.
Yeah, well, Sarah, I want to go through the menu, or I want you to go through the menu if you can, because many people may not be familiar with things like turtle drinks or even being able to use your mobile app to pay for things at McDonald's. Go through the menu for us. Tell us what's working for them, and don't leave out the garlic.
I'll try not to. I think what's working for them is what we think of as the barbell strategy, which is on the one end you have, you know, more premium products. Last year, there was a real focus on these signature crafted hamburgers, which had three different builds that you could choose from, and you could choose either a hamburger or a chicken sandwich, and you could choose different kinds of buns. So it's sort of what I would call mass customization, and they were frankly very well received because they're pretty delicious. So you had, you know, things like a pico de gallo, which also had guacamole, which tasted like real guacamole, and other builds, the two other builds, both of which had bacon, because everything tastes better with bacon. So on the one end, you had that, the premium, and then on the other end, you had them really emphasizing being competitive in value, as Stevie Strubrick would say. So not necessarily being the lowest price point and every item at every time, but having an offering like the McPick 2 for $2 or the dollar soda, $2 coffee, that was very compelling to restaurant goers. And we're seeing that again this year with the $1, $2, $3 value menu on the low end, but then also this fresh beef quarter pounder, which again is now available in the New York area, and it's a very good sandwich. So McDonald's is really trying to stay true to this philosophy of being a progressive burger company, such that they have good food that tastes good, as well sourced, but also a value price point that can appeal broadly.
Sarah, how are they able to do this so quickly?
You know, I think, you know, what we saw with the leadership turnover in 2015 was really a cultural shift. And that was very much the focus, which is, you know, be fast, be nimble, you know, fail fast, as they say. But make sure that if there's a demand for a product in the market, that McDonald's is going to meet it. So, you know, all-day breakfast is a good example of this. You know, that's probably the most requested menu item or menu addition probably since they added breakfast in the 70s. And yet for a very long time, the system was hesitant because of the operational challenges. And I think, you know, the focus this time with this management team is to make sure that things like operational challenges didn't stand in the way. Same with fresh beef quarter pounders. It's a good sandwich. They know it tested well, people liked it, and they were going to figure out a way to bring it to market.
All right, for Tom that doesn't necessarily get the McCafe that has been so popular, he can now get it in a McCafe in a bottle. Tell us about those kinds of ventures, because there's not only McCafe in a bottle, there's McCafe bags, K-cups, and canisters.
That's right. I mean, this is still a very, very small piece of their business. You know, it's always going to be hard to move the needle. You know, in the U.S., when you have 14,000 restaurants doing, you know, $2.5 million per box, you know, anything, you know, $35 billion system, it's very hard for any one product to have.
Yeah, but it's going to allow me to segue into Starbucks, so that's why I did it.
So that's what we're talking about. Okay, so then there's value to you. I think there's value there, too, to McDonald's. I mean, look, it's a testament to the fact that the brand is strong enough to be sold outside of the McDonald's restaurants. So whether it ever will be hugely meaningful, mm-hmm. probably not. But, you know, but people like the coffee.
So tell Tom about Starbucks and what their challenges are.
You know, I think, look, Starbucks is a very good global brand. You know, our view is that increasingly it may just be more mature than it's, you know, the company's willing to acknowledge or let on. You know, there's long been that joke about Starbucks on every corner, and that is increasingly, I think, part of the issue for them. There's just, you know, growth. There's only so many units you can add before they start to impact the existing business.
Sarah, before I let you go, Chipotle, 700 down to 300, I guess with an enthusiastic bounce. Where are you on CMG right now?
I mean, I like this stock. I have to say, you know, I've been sort of a long-suffering bull. We saw all these opportunities for the business, and the last management team just wasn't executing against them.
Yep.
And I think the reason you've seen this big move is because the opportunities are very much there in terms of driving top line through basic things like marketing, you know, more effective advertising, some digital initiatives.
Right.
And also a lot of costs. And we finally have a CEO and now a chief marketing officer and chief restaurant officer and IT that are there and capable of executing.
What can they learn from Stephen J. Esterbrook?
I think being nimble, being flexible, that and listening to what your customers want without going too far astray from your core value proposition, I think everybody can learn that.
Sarah, just terrific. Thank you. Sarah Senator, on short notice, on Bernstein and McDonald's. There was the L word, Pim. Listen. It's just stunning. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts Gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.